KEXP thanks contributing donors and the Real Networks Foundation for supporting Mind Over Matters.
This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Dixon Despommiers, professor of microbiology and public health at Columbia University, where he won the Best Teacher Award 6 times. Dixon also received the National 2003 American Medical Student Association Golden Apple Award for teaching. He has addressed audiences at leading universities, including Harvard and MIT, and has been invited to speak at the United Nations. Dixon Despommiers is here today to tell us about his book, The Vertical Farm, Feeding the World in the 21st Century, published in 2010 by Thomas Dunn Books. Welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
What led you to develop the idea of vertical farming? How did the idea come about?
Well, surprisingly, it occurred in a class that I taught. I no longer teach. I'm retired for about 6 months now. But the class that I taught was called Medical Ecology. And it more or less chronicled all of the disturbances in the environment that can result in a health risk. And about halfway through that course, the students, they got depressed because it didn't look so good out there after a while. And they challenged me to allow them to work on something that had more uplifting outcomes. And so the thing they picked to work on was rooftop gardening in New York City. And I encouraged it, and of course they went ahead and looked into the possibility of it. At the end of the semester, they concluded that they couldn't feed a lot of people raising food on the rooftops because there's a season, and the crops wouldn't grow year-round. And so I said, well, wait a minute, if that's the case, why don't we just move your idea inside and put it into the buildings rather than leave it on the roofs? And believe it or not, that's how this idea actually started to evolve. And every year since then, the class has picked up on the idea and added more details to it until finally what you see today is a collaborative effort of 105 students and one professor working away on this problem.
Would you elaborate on the purpose or goal of vertical farming?
Sure. From my perspective, since I am a microbiologist, if you look around the world, you can find about half of us that farm by using human feces as a fertilizer. That's because they can't afford the commercial fertilizers, and it's probably a good thing that they can't. But at the same time, of course, parasitic infections that are transmitted by fecal contamination are very common in these places. And it actually detracts away from these people's livelihoods, keeps them out of school as children, and it forces them not to achieve their maximum potential, so to speak, for life goals like, say, occupations that would involve technological bases, for instance. So I think for that reason, and for many others too, but that's a primary reason why these people have not been able to rise above their settings, because they're compromised by all of these infections that are in their gut tracts. And this would be one way to prevent that, because vertical farming doesn't employ fertilizer, basically. It's a hydroponic system, which makes use of nutrients dissolved in water, or another technology called aeroponics, and both of these are well established in the indoor growing field. And by employing both of these together in a large building that's secure, you can keep out a lot of the nasties that actually take a big bite out of our crop production every year.
Would you speak about vertical farming in regard to land use and environmental issues?
Of course. Well, another big advantage of doing it this way, of course, is that you could contemplate giving land back to nature that is currently used for farming. And by this, I'm mostly referring to the tropical rainforests that are being cut down in favor of slash-and-burn farming. Those poor people have no other choice but to do it that way, but if we gave them another choice by simply creating these vertical structures inside cities to employ these people and to supply food for them as well, you could allow the tropical rainforests to regrow back on their own, basically. The same thing would be true, of course, for other places where deforestation has given way to farming. In fact, it's estimated for every indoor acre of farming that's created, you generate some 10 to 20 outdoor acres of land that you might allow to go back to the original purpose, hardwood forest, wetlands, that sort of thing.
What would a vertical farm look like? You've alluded to that, but would you say more?
Sure. So you can imagine a totally transparent building that's more than, let's say, 5 stories. Let's make it 8 stories tall. It's made out of a transparent material, but I'm not going to use the word glass in this case because I think glass is too heavy a product to use in a big, tall building like that. And there are other alternatives that are even better. Some plastics that are being used now for indoor gardening are absolutely perfect for this. There's one in England, for instance, called the Eden Project, which I would recommend listeners going to. So imagine what this building would look like. Of course, it would have to have grow lights inside for some situations, but not necessarily all of them. The transparency of the building itself would allow a maximum amount of sunlight. So designing them not so tall, but long, and perhaps more narrow than you would imagine a city block building to be, would accommodate the growing of food and at the same time let in a lot of sunlight so that you rely less and less on electricity for supplying the necessary energy to run the grow lights with because you're using the sunlight itself. There are ways of reflecting sunlight inside of a building too, using parabolic mirrors and solar tubes, etc. So getting light into the building, as long as you've got plenty of it to begin with, would be my first recommendation. So the building takes shape based on the energy sources that are available to it. That's true for all of the Middle East, for instance, and the American Southwest, and let's say all of Australia. Anywhere where you have these hot, dry areas, this kind of farming would be absolutely stunning. In other situations, like Iceland, for instance, which is an extreme situation, of course, you could employ geothermal energy because they've got plenty of it. Just dig down a little bit and you can get all the heat you can possibly use to drive steam turbines to then make the electricity for the grow lights. So in that situation, they could run them entirely on grow lights and still be off the energy grid, so to speak, because they're using nature's energy source, namely the hot center of the earth. Another situation, you'd have to be more creative. You'd have to harness solar, geothermal, perhaps tidal power solution to offset the cost of the energy that you might generate in order to make these indoor farms work out efficiently. But to start with, you'd have to build a prototype. I don't think we can actually start to build these things without doing the proper science first. And so these kinds of issues would be addressed in those prototypes.
What types of crops could be grown in a vertical farm?
Well, that's a great question because, you know, that's what our students ask too. You know, how practical is this? I mean, if I have to eat strawberries and tomatoes for the rest of my life, I don't think I'm going to enjoy living next to a vertical farm. All they had to do was go to the NASA website. This was back in the, maybe third or fourth year of this project. We decided to make a checklist of things that, A, could be grown indoors, and then, B, have been grown indoors to commercial levels. And it's a surprisingly large list. It goes on for several pages worth of produce, and it includes things like coffee and tea and wine grapes and all kinds of products that you wouldn't possibly imagine anybody thinking of putting indoors in an aquaponic or an aeroponic situation, and yet they're not only thinking of doing it, they've done it. So herbs and spices and berries that can be grown on bushes and vine vegetables like green beans and cucumbers and pumpkins, and the list is staggering, to be very honest with you. It was quite surprising to me to find out how much interest there was in getting this developed to a point where it didn't matter where you lived, the produce could be generated to meet that cuisine need.
Are there types of crops that wouldn't work well in a vertical farm?
Well, I think trees would be, I like trees and I would like them to stay outside. Trees are great at soaking up carbon from the atmosphere and growing bigger by the minute. And, you know, even though they produce fruit and they're sort of stunted on purpose by pruning, the trees, the trunks still continue to grow, the roots still continue to grow, and they continue to sequester carbon. So I would leave those outdoors. But things like miniature banana trees, that could easily be grown indoors, and it has been actually. Avocado plants have been miniaturized and grown indoors. The fruit is the same size as the outdoor plants, but the plant itself is much smaller. It's been adapted to indoor life. And that having been said, I think perhaps some of your listeners might be leery of the entire process of putting food production indoors, and the word genetic modification comes up sometimes in conversations. And I'm not suggesting any of that for this technology. There's no need at all to tailor-make plants for indoor life, other than supplying them with enough sunlight, an organic source of nitrogen, and the micronutrients that they need to live on, plus, of course, the ones we need. That's all been worked out already, and I think it's a fairly old technology using hydroponics, and plants are quite used to it as long as you keep their roots aerated.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Dixon Despommier, author of the book The Vertical Farm, Feeding the World in the 21st Century. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM, and on the web at kexp.org. Would you say more about the use of water on a vertical farm and how much would be required?
Sure. It's a precious commodity, as you know, and it's not just water we're talking about. It's fresh water, too. So if you put all of the water on Earth into a large container, I don't care how large that container is, and you took a teaspoon and took that out and held that alongside of it, that's how much fresh water there is compared to how much total water there is. So fresh water on Earth is what we need. We need 2.3 liters of this every day as adults. And we use over 70% of our fresh water that's liquid to grow our food. It's all used for agricultural purposes. And as a result, It's no longer usable after that because of the agricultural runoff issues that occur with farming and irrigation. Hydroponics is an indoor technology that uses 70% less water than outdoor farming. And aeroponics is a version of hydroponics that uses 70% less water than hydroponics. So if we could do everything by aeroponics, we could save a tremendous amount of fresh water, which we would, of course, then be able to drink ourselves.
Would you explain more about aeroponics, what the technology actually is?
Happily. Let's take hydroponics first. It's referred to as nutrient film technology. There's a thin layer of water on the bottom of a trough which contains the dissolved nutrients for the plants. The root systems sort of hang down into that solution as it gently trickles down this pipe, and the nutrients and water are taken up by the plants, and they use the nutrients to grow with, of course, and they evaporate the water out of their leaves. If you took that system and then made it into an atomized spray, much the same as a perfume bottle does, or some of the spray cans that you can pump yourself to get it to spray, you can now imagine a mist of nutrient-laden water. And that's the next level. That's now called aeroponics. And it's the technology that NASA and other space agencies are really looking to because of the precious quantity of water that you'd have to take with you if you want to go from here to Mars is limited. And you can't afford the outdoor farming formula of using all that water just to grow your food, but you still need to grow food. So the aeroponic system has a lot of advantages in that sense.
Earlier, you spoke about the energy for vertical farms. How does the energy needed for a vertical farm compare with the energy needed for traditional farming?
Well, I wish I could answer that question for you because I've heard as many versions of the answer to that question as you can possibly get from people that are highly supportive of it and say there's plenty of energy in LED lighting and there's lots left over and you don't have to worry about the expenses to... It's an impossible situation which you can't possibly match with outdoor farming because the sunlight is free and you get so much of it that the plants don't know what to do with it. In fact, they only use about 2% of the incoming sunlight anyway. Somewhere between the extreme you can't do it and the extreme it's going to be a simple thing lies the real answer to that question. And that's the very reason why I'm supporting the development of prototypical vertical farms first to explore configuration of buildings, the kinds of lighting you might want to use, the availability of energy. And, like I mentioned, if you were living in Iceland, energy wouldn't be a consideration because it's there for the taking, basically. And I think you might look at some other places like that, too. In fact, the American Midwest might be one of those other places where you've got lots of wind, unharnessed. But if you decided to harness it, it would offset the energy budget, no matter how intense the energy usage would be for the LED lighting that you might imagine here. And there's one final source of energy that I must mention, and that is every time each of us defecates, and I'm using a polite term here, of course, that event is worth something in terms of energy. It's mostly bacteria and undigested plant material, and if you were to then dry it down to completion and then incinerate it, it would be an energy-rich fuel source. And it's the one thing in our world that we try very hard but with difficulty to get rid of. So I'm saying that all communities, before you start talking about the energy budget of vertical farming as being a negative, if you don't harness the energy locked up in our own excrement first, then we're not behaving ecologically. And I think that vertical farming has as its basis ecological behavior. So in nature, as you know, nothing is wasted and everything is sustainable as long as we don't disturb it. And so that's the reason why I'm looking at cities behaving in the same fashion. And we begin with food production, and if you do that, you have to link it to what happens after you eat your food because that's what happens in nature as well. So the sustainability, I think, of the energy budget for vertical farming will come when we finally realize that our own waste products could serve as the basis for the generation of some of the energy needed to actually make our food to begin with.
Where will the land to build vertical farms come from in an already built-up urban area?
If you were the mayor of New York City, one of the easiest things for a mayor to identify is unrealized income from abandoned properties. Every city has them, and if you look very hard, and sometimes not too hard, you can find huge amounts of it. In New York, for instance, we have something called Floyd Bennett Air Force Base. It's 3.5 square miles of abandoned property. In 1967, the Air Force stopped using it, and we've never been able to find another use for it. Even land developers haven't moved in and built it up with apartment houses, etc. So it's still lying fallow next to the ocean with lots of sunshine, lots of tidal power, lots of wind power. Even wave power could be considered here. We could easily put some prototype farms there to start playing with the concept and to see what works best. If you go around the country, I've just come back from a trip to Chicago, and remember Chicago in the old days, it used to be the hub of meat processing, and it was processed in a place called the Stockyards, and the Stockyards are still available, believe it or not. They have not been built over, and there's a ton of open space that Chicago is willing to dedicate to urban farming development, and I'm sure Seattle has some of that kind of land around as well, and I know I've been to Portland, and they've shown me lots of properties there, too. So San Francisco, Los Angeles, all of the big cities seem to have some of these properties that if someone were to come along with a new set of technologies, and in this case, they don't have to be new, but they have to be applied in a new way, you could put a big smile on every mayor throughout the cities of the United States simply by saying, oh, we'll do this there. And the mayor would say, absolutely, come right on in.
How expensive would the produce or food produced by a vertical farm be compared to typical produce?
Yeah, well, let's start with the concept that outdoor farming can't produce produce all year. So if you're an indoor farmer, at least you have the advantage of winters, where no matter what the situation is outdoors, as long as you put a restriction on food miles, and of course we don't, so the price of food is generated by all kinds of factors related to fossil fuel use and flying produce in from Chile and that sort of thing. But a lettuce farm, for instance, that's been online from Cornell University's School of Agriculture, demonstrated quite amply that an indoor hydroponic lettuce farm could generate some 64 heads of lettuce per square foot per year. That's a lot of lettuce, by the way, and each head of lettuce would have cost, let's say, a dollar. And they did the metrics on this to show you that you could actually make a very nice profit simply by making baby heads of lettuce, in this case, for the high-end restaurants of Ithaca and the surrounding areas. I think if you work up that model for other crops, the price may drop a little bit or it may go up a little bit depending on what you're producing. So you'd have to actually make it crop-specific in order to give a really good answer for that question. But you could also say, I'll bet you don't know how much your outdoor food costs. Because of government and local subsidies, the price of fossil fuels is being subsidized tremendously. In the United States, we use 20% of the fossil fuels to grow our food. If we were to factor that into the equation at the proper price for fossil fuels, I think the price of food would be so high that nobody could afford it. So on purpose, it's kept low so that we can afford it. It's a difficult comparison.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Dixon Despommier, author of the book, The Vertical Farm, Feeding the World in the 21st Century. What fraction of our food needs could be potentially met by vertical farms, in your view?
Another spot-on question. Diane and I think the answer to it would be dependent upon the culture that you're addressing with the vertical farm. Let me just say that besides vegetables and plants in general, you can also raise fish in an aquaculture situation, and you can raise mollusks and crustaceans like shrimp and lobsters and the crayfish. That's all been done to commercial levels indoors. And some of the crops that you would grow as plants could be the food for these particular animals, like, say, for instance, tilapia. They're grain-eating fish, so that you could actually grow some of their own food in the vertical farm as part of the setup. Chickens wouldn't be out of the question either, and ducks and geese. I think I would draw the line to pigs. So if you were to ask how many calories per person could be grown indoors per day, you know, and then times 365, I would guess that if you needed 1,500 calories, you could generate 1,000 of those calories by urban farms and the commercial farms inside the city limits. I think when four-legged animals are considered like cattle, sheep, pigs, I think the equation becomes a little more iffy to calculate. But based on just what we know we can grow indoors, you could probably get 60% of what you need from an urban farm.
In your view, who is likely to benefit the most from creation of vertical farms?
You know, I teach at a school of public health, or at least I did. My heart is in public health. My head is there, too, by the way, I should say. And the people that I would like most to benefit from this in the long term are those people that have no hope whatsoever of making their own food supplies. And I'm now talking about disadvantaged groups of people that live in places like Darfur, or whole countries in West Africa that get wiped out each year by plant diseases, for instance, or locusts that come in and eat their crops, or an enormous number of people living inside large cities now in places like India and China that go to bed each night with a single meal in their stomach and wish they had two or three. These vertical farms have the potential for addressing that issue, but not right away. I realize that there's got to be some commercialization of this, and the people that can most afford it are not the people that I've just talked about. But in the long term, I mean, I've done a fair amount of traveling over the last several years, and I've seen places like India where if I'm in an audience and I say, how many people here have a cell phone? Every hand goes up, and it's incredible to see how many people who you would never suspected being able to afford something like that 10 years ago, they couldn't, of course, and even 5 years ago. But today, since the demand is so high and since the sales are so rich in terms of generating income for these companies, everybody can now finally afford a cell phone. Well, I think anything that's worth doing like that will eventually succeed. And I sincerely believe that urban farming is here to stay, that's for sure. And vertical farming is just an extension of that activity. And so that I think the people that need it most are the ones that now suffer from malnutrition, either obesity or not enough food, teenage diabetes, type 2 diabetes, teenage obesity, that sort of thing. Those are the people that I'd really like to see benefit most.
How close are we to building the first vertical farm?
Well, if I hadn't gone to Chicago last week, I would have said, I don't know. Fortunately, I did go to Chicago last week. I did find out that there's a company in Milwaukee that's actually constructing a 5-story vertical farm as we speak. It's not a high-tech vertical farm, not with all the bells and whistles that you might imagine. To go into a new multi-million-dollar version of this as the prototype that I've suggested, but given a low line of budget and given the Will Allen approach to producing food, and people may be familiar with Will Allen's initiatives in Milwaukee, this group has broken off from his original farming initiatives and formed a company which has a real possibility of creating a 5-story vertical farm within the next 6 months. So you're going to see low-tech versions soon. And the high-tech versions, I think, will soon follow.
What do you see as the key challenges to overcome in the development of vertical farming?
Ownership. You know, everybody says it'd be great if you could show a profit at the end of the day, and it doesn't matter how much it costs, as long as you can predict return on investment. You know, I've sort of learned how to think and talk like a business person, but I must promise you that I am not a business entity in any way, shape, or form. But I know that if you can't present a realistic business model to investors, they'll turn their backs on you and look for other opportunities. So you have to convince people that this is a worthwhile investment, not just for the short term, but for the long term also. I think the biggest difficulty is getting these prototypes established, and I think we're going to need some federal programs for that, to take federal funding and along with private investment and promises of licensing fees with regards to intellectual property that might be generated inside these prototypes, and get them up and running soon, because I think that once they are, they can generate a tremendous interest in the community in general, and in specific, they can jumpstart a whole bunch of smaller versions of vertical farms that could be highly profitable in the short term.
Overall, what kind of response are you getting to the idea of vertical farms?
Well, they didn't laugh. In fact, nobody's laughed. I've had now 105 graduate students work on this project over the last 11 years, and I've never had one of them get up in the middle of my course and cross it off and say, that was a waste of time, I think I'll register for something else. No, in fact, I've had buy-in from virtually every group that I've had an opportunity of presenting the details of this to.
What do you see as disadvantages to vertical farms, if any?
Well, a lot of people have raised the issue about farming in general and the farmers and what's going to happen to them. What if this is highly successful, and what if farming now becomes an urban activity and ignores all those poor dirt farmers out there? And I have two answers. One is that dirt farmers are going out of business, and they know it as well as everybody else. And it's unfortunate but true, because farming in general, because of climate change issues and poor soils, soil erosion due to either droughts or floods, has really limited where successful farming can occur. So you see this big migration in areas of China and India to the cities. People are throwing up their hands and saying, now what do I do, because I can't farm any longer? So that's one issue that I could address just by saying, I don't have to say anything about farming, and the concept of vertical farming doesn't even have to exist in order for me to prove to you that farming in general is not sustainable. It is truly not sustainable. It's been around for only around 12,000 years, and already we're facing major problems of sustainability with regards to soil types and nutrient levels and water and safety issues. So I think that in the long term, given another 12,000 years, that's only 24,000 years of history, and that sounds like a long time, but it's actually a pretty short time considering how long we've been around for a species. I think the biggest challenge will be how can we produce our food in a way that doesn't spoil the ecology of the rest of the world. And in order for us to rethink that process, we have to look at the ecology of the rest of the world first and find out what's wrong with it, address those issues by not doing that anymore and doing things that favor our existence as well as the rest of nature. This is one way to do it.
So do you believe that current conventional farming is going to disappear entirely?
I couldn't. No, I would be crazy to say that. I think anybody would be crazy to say that. I think traditional farming will always exist because two reasons. One is because it can, and the second reason is because people love doing it. When they can do it the way they want to do it, I think there's nobody happier than a farmer that's just produced food for somebody else. And I've talked to many of them, and I understand their point of view, and I don't disagree at all with that, in fact. But I think farming will become as limited. The climate change issues are real here, and the estimate is for every degree of temperature increase in the Earth's atmosphere, you lose about 10% of the amount of land that you could have farmed if that degree of change hadn't occurred. So all you need is 3 or 4 degrees of change, and you've compromised about 30 to 40% of where you can now farm. So it will be restricted. And by restricting it, then the price of food will go way up, and there'll be more have-nots and fewer haves, unfortunately. And that's the prediction of many groups. And if that's the case, we should start looking for other ways of farming.
What steps need to be taken to help develop vertical farms?
Yeah, well, it comes back to the prototypes. So we need central funding from government sources that supports private initiatives, as well as college-based or university-based research. And you know, you're sitting in the middle of a wonderful place out in Seattle with University of Washington, Boeing Corporation, and the city of Seattle could make a wonderful partnership in getting together and saying, if we had a prototype to work on, we could probably generate a lot of interest in indoor farming within the Seattle community. And I think the Gates Foundation would be a natural source to look for funding for this purpose as well. I've talked with people in Portland. They're in discussion now with the state government, and I know that they've had some problems there, but they've got a good ear. The people of Oregon are willing to listen to this because any new industry would address job opportunities and unemployment options for putting people that are now unemployed back to work. And of course, if it relates to food, so much the better.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, the message is I want to leave them with my dream. And what my dream is that I wake up one day and I call up my grandkids and my great-grandkids, and I invite them to dinner. And what we're going to eat for dinner is being raised in that vertical farm right across the street from where I live.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Dixon.
Diane, thank you for having me.
You have just been listening to Dixon Despommiers, author of the book The Vertical Farm, Feeding the World in the 21st Century, published in 2010 by Thomas Dunn Books. For more information, check on the web at www.verticalfarm.com. Again, that's verticalfarm.com. The Sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.